This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll be talking with prominent constitutional law professor David Cole from Georgetown University to talk about civil disobedience at Georgetown.
Cole, point by point, can refute everything they're saying about why the administration thinks NSA illegal spying is legal. Cole was there at Georgetown on the dais with Gonzalez when students turned their backs on him in utter protest.
We'll listen to a speech made by our own Michael Ratner at the recent Bush War Crimes Commission in New York.
We've been working politically with Michael Ratner for many years, all of us, and I tell you, I think this was his finest moment.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, ACLU's Arab Muslim South Asian advocate.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Many of our listeners may be wondering where our fourth host, Dahlia Hashad, is. As you notice, she has not been with us for a few weeks.
Dahlia is on an extended vacation in her homeland of Egypt.
She's under instructions from us to observe carefully and report back. So come next month, we're going to have a firsthand report from Dahlia when she gets back from Cairo.
This administration is, as we have said before, is on the road to tyranny. For one of our first items, we're thinking about, we've talked about it in the past, the signing statement on the McCain Amendment and other signing statements. Those are statements that the president signs when he agrees to legislation that Congress has passed. Heidi, what are those things?
Well, the statements, basically, and I must say that this president has signed, I think, almost 500 since he's been in office. It's a way that the president gets to put his input onto something after Congress passes a law that he doesn't like, but he doesn't want to veto that law.
Now, this isn't the first president who's used those,
no,
right?
No, it's used regularly.
Because I remember one back in the Nixon years on the War Powers Resolution, because I've litigated under that, and he passed a statement saying, well, I don't really believe this is constitutional, and I'll do something to sort of comply with it, but it's not really a legal law to limit my war power. So Nixon already was doing this kind of stuff.
Nixon did it a couple times. Other presidents did it a couple times. Bushy has done it more times than every other president in the history of America. And I think what's so scary about it is that he took an oath of office to enforce the law, not to undercut it.
John Dean wrote a great article on signing statements because a lot of people have never heard of them. And I'd just like to quote, he says, Bush has quietly been using these statements to bolster presidential powers. It is a calculated, systematic scheme that has gone largely unnoticed.
What they basically do, basically say, it's up to me as to what the law means. If I don't like this law, I'm not going to enforce it. That's what they come down to. But I want you to mention that, but also mention who John Dean is.
John Dean was counsel to President Nixon.
Right, and he was one of the people involved in the Watergate scandal.
Exactly, and testified at length during that. So this is a really credible piece. And a couple of points that are worth mentioning is that when Bush signs these statements, essentially it nullifies the laws that have been passed by Congress as it relates to the executive branch. The statements sort of function as directives to the departments and agencies as to how they are to implement the relevant law. Bush, and I think his advisors, probably think that these statements can help him if the laws are later construed in the courts.
Right. They also want the courts, when they look at the laws, to look at these statements as to what Congress supposedly meant, or at least what the executive thinks about it.
So, Michael, Heidi, what do you think this does to the separation of powers?
What separation of powers?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I mean, you know, we all made fun of that in high school and junior high, separation of powers, checks and balances. It's all part of the same system. What's the difference? But in fact, there is some ability of the Congress and the judiciary, or at least we thought so, to hold back a runaway executive. And the question coming up in this period is that ability there any longer with a very spineless Congress, courts that are being overrun, and a president who says in these signing statements and in other ways, I don't care what Congress says. I don't care what the courts do. To protect the national security, I can do whatever I want. And he does that partly in the signing statements, partly with his position on the National Security Agency wiretaps, partly in holding people at Guantanamo, partly in torturing people and saying, I don't care what happens. So we have a runaway executive.
Yeah, and he uses fear and a compliant media, which, you know, pretty much, you know, is embedded in the White House as a megaphone to amplify the fear that Bush stirs up. And he gets people scared enough, so they figure they're trading their liberty for security here. And they go along with this guy taking over powers of the other branches of the government.
But there may be a backlash. In his article, Dean also suggests that people within the executive branch become troubled when a president overreaches to the extent that Bush has. And there may be leaks. And after the leaks start, congressional anger follows. The overwhelming congressional support for McCain's torture ban, for example, suggests that Congress is not happy if leaks begin to suggest that the president is flouting the ban.
One of the problems, though, you know, I like to think there's a backlash, but if you read what's going on with the NSA wiretapping, where they call it terrorist wiretapping, and that it's clearly illegal, there's not an issue, and we're going to talk about that. We'll hear from David Cole today about that, but clearly illegal, and they're putting up forth this position with president going out on the road, Gonzalez going out on the road, Hayden, the head of the NSA, going out on the road, asserting legal. You know, a certain percentage of this country, in fact, almost a majority of the country, believes that if it's necessary to go after terrorists, you should be able to engage in warrantless wiretapping. Absurd, obviously ridiculous, because why don't you get a warrant? But somehow it goes back to that you can fool some of the people some of the time. And the question here is, can you actually fool a majority of the people all the time? And I don't know. I don't think the answer's there.
It's a big question, and I think it depends a lot on people like you and me and Heidi and people out there listening. We got to start educating and agitating, getting people moving now.
Educating is key because although what Michael said is accurate, when people are armed with the real facts, their opinions tend to change. It's sort of like with the death penalty. When they really know how it's imposed, with all the flaws that the system has, they begin to change their mind. And I think here a lot of people don't really know that the FISA court exists, there are provisions to get warrants legally and quickly, but that Bush, they don't talk about that, and they don't like the media talking about that.
Bush gets out there and says, and Cheney too, well, if somebody from Al-Qaeda is calling somebody in Idaho, we want to know about it. Well, that's not what it's about at all, is it, Michael?
No, it's not at all. They can go to the war. They can go to the court if they want to get a warrant against someone they suspect of terrorism. What they're really doing, as we have said in our center's lawsuit, is they're going after, we believe, attorneys like us who are communicating with our clients overseas. They're going after American citizens who are talking outside the country. They're going after their emails. They're doing widespread surveillance. So, yes, we hope that through knowledge and through action that we'll be able to persuade people. But, you know, this hole that they're putting this country into and this Constitution is getting deeper and deeper. And there's still time to act. You know, you don't want to let them pile too much dirt on you while you're down there. You start digging yourself out, I'll tell you, because you can go through every issue that we talk about, from torture to spying to Guantanamo to other issues in non-civil liberties areas. And they are really on a offensive in terms of cutting back liberty and enhancing the executive.
Yeah, it was just extraordinary that Bush made this very public visit to the headquarters of the NSA. They dug out General Michael, what's his last
Hayden.
Name? Hayden. Whoever even heard of that guy? And they put him on national TV.
Scary and he gave an guy. Embarrassing speech, actually, with I think when we get David Cole on here, a number of faults.
Well, he assured everybody that he was in the faith community and that he sided with people whose mothers took him to soccer games.
Well, that was my favorite
Virginia.
Expression. My favorite thing he said was, he said, what do you think we are? We're people who believe in American constitutional and privacy. We go to soccer games. We take our kids to these games. We're just like you guys living in the suburbs. You know what it made me think of? I don't know if a lot of our listeners remember the book, Hannah Arendt's book, The Banality of Evil.
That's exactly what I thought
what
of.
What it made me think of is how the very people who carry out these nasty policies, that from torture to wiretapping are the very person who's living around the corner from you, taking their kid to soccer, just like they were in Germany when they were taking people to the ovens.
Well, Hannah,
I got to tell you, that's what we're talking
Hannah
about.
Hannah Arendt made the point, and Bill Kunstler echoed it in his book, The Emerging Police State, that everything that these creeps did was done according to the law. You know, when Hitler issued those famous decrees in March and February of 1933, giving him the right to not only make the laws in Germany, but then interpret them, which is what Bush is talking about now, everything was done according to the law. And Kunstler writes about, you know, every person that was put on every train and every piece of gold that was taken out of everybody's mouth and every gallon of gas that was ordered for the ovens and so on, it was all done pursuant to bureaucratic typewriter.
And
it was called
the Fuhrer's Law, because the Fuhrer was the law. That's what we have today. I mean, that is really the direction this country is moving in, and people ought to be very, very alarmed.
Yeah, well, that's, I think, what scares the pants off of old-time conservative Republicans like Paul Craig Roberts and many people like him who have come forward recently.
Well, there's a couple more things we should just mention. There was one that just got a little notice, which shows you there's so much water going over the dam. They changed it's by an executive order or by a regulation, whereas normally executions in the military or outside the United States pursuant to a sentence have to be carried out in the United States. They have now changed the law to say that executions by the United States, let's say a person at Guantanamo gets convicted of the death penalty, or in some trial on some ship somewhere out in the world, or in some country where we have a secret detention facility, if somehow they get convicted, whatever that word means in the current climate, they can be executed wherever the United States decides to execute them, and it can be done in secret. So what you have here is trials in secret, then the execution in secret, and then presumably, let's say it's on an aircraft carrier, they dump the body overboard. That's just a little rule change that they decided to do this week. And what do you read about it? You read nothing about it.
But those individuals who, unfortunately, might be sentenced to death, it all falls under United States law, the original sentencing.
Well, it certainly should. But, you know, this administration thinks they can hold trials in complete secret according to their orders. I mean, in Guantanamo, we've been able to force them to open them up. We just don't know what's going on in the rest of the world. We really don't. I mean, there's these – another thing that happened in the last week is, again, there's been reports about this issue of outsourcing torture and renditions. And we had a report from the Swiss investigator from the European Union saying these are very credible, that the European countries were cooperating in sending people for torture. And, of course, he's being, you know, booed and everything by European countries. But this guy, Marty from Switzerland, is out there. And they surfaced a memo that went from the Egyptian State Department, whatever they call it, to the Egyptian embassy in London that said at least 23 people are being held in a country in Europe at the behest of the U.S., and that this is going on throughout Europe. And this is an Egyptian memo. And then there was a memo
from
the—
And do they know the exact location?
They mentioned—I think that was the one they mentioned, Romania, that there were 23 people being held in that prison. And then there was another memo that came out of the United Kingdom about this outsourcing torture. That one said, well, we know this is probably illegal. The best thing to do is divert attention and say the United States has gotten assurances from countries that people won't be tortured there, which we all know is
means
BS.
Nothing.
We are in trouble, guys. But there's a struggle going on. There's more opposition going on. And as we're here today, we'll hear about a great protest that just took place at Georgetown, which, if you're talking about the Cuban concept of emulation rather than competition, I would like all our listeners to emulate what happened at Georgetown.
Pretty inspiring.
As a special announcement to our listeners, we want to bring to your attention two events. One of them is taking place on Tuesday, January 31st. It's titled Inside the Cages, Guantanamo, Get the Truth Behind the Headlines. And on January 31st, Tuesday, from 4 to 7 p.m., Barbara Olshansky of the Center for Constitutional Rights will be giving an update on what will be the fate of the Guantanamo detainees. It will take place at 113 University Place. That's 113 University Place in Manhattan between 12th and 13th Street. For details on the program Inside the Cages, Guantanamo, go to the Law and Disorder website, that's lawanddisorder.org, or call the Center for Constitutional Rights, that's 212-614-6464. As many of our listeners know, for a number of weeks, we have been covering the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and the terrible tragedy that has unfolded in large part as a result of federal government inaction. There's an important forum on Hurricane Katrina. It's being run by the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. That organization is run by the former executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Ron Daniels. This event is taking place in Brooklyn at the House of the Lord Church, 415 Atlantic Avenue. That's House of the Lord Church, 415 Atlantic Avenue, between Nevins and Bond. It will take place on Saturday afternoon, February 4th, from 2 to 4 o'clock. That's Saturday afternoon from 2 to 4 o'clock. There, you will hear speakers including Cynthia Willard Lewis, the councilwoman for the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans and in New Orleans East. It's an important forum. Ron has just come back from New Orleans. Cynthia, of course, is the councilwoman for the district. It should be an amazing, remarkable event. Again, Saturday afternoon, February 4th, House of the Lord Church, 415 Atlantic Avenue. Today we have with us David Cole, a professor at Georgetown University Law School and also a board member of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's one of the lawyers in the case that the center has brought against the National Security Agency protesting or objecting to the illegal warrantless wiretapping that the NSA has been engaged in. Welcome to Law and Disorder, David.
Thanks for having me.
David, a couple of days ago, you were at Georgetown on the dais giving a lecture or talking about the NSA spying, and I know with you was the Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez. Can you give us a sense of what happened that day? I know there was a protest and then something about the law. What was the protest about?
Well, the Attorney General came to Georgetown as part of the administration's public relations campaign, in which they have every day had a major speech on why this program is legal, and this was just one of their opportunities to make their case. They decided to do it at Georgetown Law School, and the law school was happy to have him, and we set up a panel, balanced panel, to respond after he concluded his remarks. But a number of the students in the school independently decided to conduct a protest, and I said during the proceedings that I thought it was the most civil form of civil disobedience that I'd ever witnessed, because they did not disrupt the speech in any way, but over the course of the speech, about 20 of the students at various times simply stood up quietly, turned around, and refused to face Gonzalez. Some of them had slogans and things, I love liberty and things on their shirts. And one group of students in the very back of the room stood up, put black hoods over their heads, reminiscent of the Abu Ghraib photos, and held up a large banner facing not Alberto Gonzalez, but the more important audience, the camera, because all the cameras, the news cameras were there, paraphrasing Ben Franklin's quote about how those who would sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither. And they did not in any way disrupt the speech. Gonzalez didn't miss a beat. He was able to make his speech. But they succeeded in showing their deep opposition to the positions of the administration. And they succeeded, I think, in disrupting what the administration saw as a public relations photo op for them. And they turned it into a public relations photo op for liberty, because their banner was the main photo that came out from this event and went around the world on CNN.com, on all the blog, very, very widely covered.
David, what, if anything, was the response from the Georgetown administration to this protest?
The dean of the law school was there at the event. He did not, he chose not to intervene by removing the students. He did send security to require the students. At one point, the banner was up so high that the cameras couldn't see the speaker. They asked the students to bring the banner down.
The picture was great. I mean, there was one in the Times and CNN of the banner is the main thing with the students with their backs.
Yeah.
Gonzalez up at the podium, David Cole, as you face the podium to the left, smaller picture than Gonzalez, but but there nonetheless, nonetheless, and it really it just gave me tremendous inspiration. First, that it happened at Georgetown Law School, and that you think these guys, Gonzalez, John Yoo, you know, the author of the torture memoirs, are going around the country speaking, and these are the kinds of protests that would be great to have be happening everywhere.
Well, you know, I think it was a very good protest, and I would draw the line at disrupting the speech altogether. I they did it in a way that didn't interfere with the ability of other students to hear the point of view or the ability of the listeners to hear the point of view, but they made their point. And I can't tell you how many emails I've gotten since then, many of which have you know, from people who say, I'm proud to be an American.
Yeah, I think it's just wonderful.
Of course, I've also gotten an equal number of emails filled with vitriol and hatred and all kinds of words that you can't say on the radio, attacking Georgetown, attacking me, and attacking the students for daring to not pay full respect to the Attorney General.
Well, you know, if we don't do these kinds of things, if we don't do them now, we may never have a chance to do them.
We live in a country where the administration is asserting unchecked power. As long as they say the magic words commander-in-chief, they can... They assert they can violate the NSA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. They assert they can violate the torture statute. They can violate the McCain Amendment, you name it. But one of the things that we still do have is the ability of American people to stand up and say, no, you know, that's not the kind of America that we want. That's not the kind of America that we are going to be a part of. And we're going to fight for our rights and for a system of checks and balances and the rule of law. And so I think the students were in that tradition.
Sounds like a perfect, I mean, demonstration, because you even got the dean not to remove the people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty quite remarkable, really.
Yeah, we made that a big mistake when I was at the University of Wisconsin back in the 60s. Teddy Kennedy had just gotten elected senator, and he was supporting the war in Vietnam. And he came out, and the anti-war movement in Madison tried to stop him from speaking. And when he would get up, they would yell and so on. And it was a bad mistake, because instead of focusing on this illegal war against the Vietnamese, the anti-war movement got accused of trying to stifle free speech. And
right.
That was what was so intelligent about what the students at Georgetown did. They just did a perfect job of it. But David, let me ask, what did Gonzalez say in support of this power grab on the wiretapping, and what's wrong with it?
He essentially repeated the kind of legal defense that they have made in memos to Congress and in letters to Congress and the like. And it's a really a remarkably weak case when you actually think it through. The first argument they make is that the program is actually authorized by the authorization to use military force against al-Qaeda, that when Congress authorized the president to use all necessary and appropriate military force against al-Qaeda, they somehow authorized him to engage in warrantless wiretapping on Americans. Now, the problem with that argument is that there's not a word in the authorization about wiretapping, and there is a specific statute, part of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, Section 1811, which expressly addresses exactly this issue. It says it's called authorization during times of war, and it says when a war breaks out, the president has 15 days and no longer to conduct warrantless wiretapping. And for any further warrantless wiretapping that he wants, he's got to come to us and show why he needs it and what the conditions are. And they went further and said it's a crime to conduct warrantless wiretapping beyond that 15 days. And so you've got a situation where you have a very specific statute that very clearly proscribes the president from doing warrantless wiretapping beyond 15 days, and you can't, in the law, you can't use a general, open-ended statute that says nothing about a subject to override a statute that addresses that specific question, and here it's warrantless wiretapping. So the first argument they make is that the authorization to use military force authorizes it. It's completely contrary to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which foursquare says it's not authorized. And then the next argument they make is, well, the president has inherent executive power as commander-in-chief to engage in warrantless wiretapping in the conduct of a war, and therefore it's unconstitutional for Congress to restrict the president in his collection of signals intelligence. And that argument is unprecedented. No court has ever upheld the right of a president as commander-in-chief to override any statutory restriction that Congress has placed on the conduct of the war, and there are many. Congress subjects the president to the laws of war, to the Uniform Code of Military military justice, the criminal ban on torture, the McCain Amendment. All of these laws restrict the president and his commander-in-chief authority. So Congress has traditionally regulated the president's authority as commander-in-chief. It's not an unregulable subject. And what the Supreme Court has said is that when the president acts in contravention of statutory directives, his power is at its lowest ebb, and he can only take action in contravention of a clear statutory directive if Congress has no power to regulate on the subject. And Congress clearly has power to regulate on the subject of wiretapping of America.
We're talking with Professor David Cole of Georgetown University Law School on the recent disruption at the law school when our Attorney General Gonzalez came out in support of warrantless wiretapping.
Well, not really disruption, a respectful protest of turning their backs to one of the Bush spokespeople, Alberto Gonzalez, who was trying to articulate the so-called reasons for warrantless wiretapping and why it would be legal. And David Cole, I think, spoke after he did, and he's just given us some of his views about that. And I think David's quote in the paper was great after that. I think you said something, David, that reminded me of Lincoln, that you can keep saying this is legal and the administration keeps saying it time after time and putting it in our face. But I think, I don't know how you ended it, but it's just not legal.
I mean, I think what I said to the students was, you know, as a student, you're taught that if you don't have the law on your side, you argue the facts. If you don't have the facts on your side, you argue the law. And I said, I guess what this shows is that if you don't have either the law or the facts on your side, you mount a massive public relations campaign and go out and repeat it often enough so that hopefully the American people will start to believe it, even though there's nothing to it. And I think, you know, that to me, that's what's going on here. To me, the administration is very nervous about this program, and rightfully so, because there is not a decent legal argument in favor of it. And so they've taken the view that the best defense is a good offense, and they've gone on a very, very strong offensive effort to try to just, you know, use the power of the pulpit. Every time the president makes a speech, the attorney general makes a speech, Michael Hayden, the former director of NSA, now national security advisor, makes a speech, it has to be covered by the media. And so they get their message out day one, day two, day three, day four, and that's going to affect the American people's views of the matter. So, because, you know, these issues are not, they require a fair amount of exposition to demonstrate why they're so weak. I think when you do that exposition, it's quite clear, and that's reflected in the fact that a wide range of people from both sides of the aisle have expressed deep skepticism about any legal authority for this program, from people like Senator Specter to longtime conservative supporters of the administration like Bruce Fine, to Richard Epstein, who's a very conservative professor at the University of Chicago, who signed a letter along with Yale law professor Harold Coe and myself and a number of others, are making the argument that there's really no legal authority for this. But I think their view is, look, you know, this is a political battle, and we're going to turn it into a political battle, and we're going to use the power of the presidency to get our message out there, and whether it makes sense or not, if we repeat it enough, we will prevail.
And I guess that's one explanation for the polls that have been coming out, that at least there's somewhat even split, if not worse, on this issue in the country.
It depends on how you ask the question.
I think the polls, I think, you know, that just reflect the fact that we're in the midst of this debate. It does depend on how you characterize the issue. But, of course, they have a lot of control there, too, because they know the facts of the program. We don't know the facts of the program. All we know are what has been leaked from the New York Times, and they're able to sort of portray it in ways that are very misleading. So, for example, one of the things they say again and again is, well, if an al-Qaeda person's calling into the United States, do you want us to turn off the phone, the taps? That's a completely misleading question, because the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act does not require you to turn off the taps just because an al-Qaeda person calls into the United States. If you're targeting a foreign national abroad, and that's the target of your surveillance, and you're acquiring the information from a tap acquired abroad, FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, does not apply whatsoever. So you can, even if the al-Qaeda person is calling someone in Chicago, they can listen in on that phone call consistent with the law without a warrant, as long as they're targeting the person outside the country. They only have to get a warrant when they start to target Americans or they acquire the information through a tap in the United States. Then the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act applies. But then it doesn't require you to turn off the tap either. It says you just have to make a showing that the target is connected to a foreign terrorist organization. And if you make that showing, you can continue the tap-the-tap, and you can even put the tap on without getting approval first. You can put the tap on and then go within 72 hours and get approval thereafter. So this is a pretty reasonable regulation of the power to conduct foreign intelligence wiretapping. It gives the president substantial tools in connection with the conflict, and it simply says that you've got to follow the law when you're tapping people in the United States and when you're targeting Americans.
David, it's been a delight to have you with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you,
David.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Professor David Cole, Georgetown professor, expert on national security agencies wiretapping, and recently there for a speech and a demonstration against Alberto Gonzalez, where a number of students at his law school, David's law school, turned their backs on Gonzalez, held up signs, war hoods, and began a protest that we would hope, as the hosts of this show, is replicated throughout the country when these purveyors of tyranny, is all you can call people like Gonzalez, when these guys are speaking all across the country. I kill, therefore I am. I don't like the black man, for he does not know his place. Take the back of my hand, or I'll spray you with my mace. I'm as brave as any man can be. I find my courage through chemistry. I'm the masculine American man. I kill, therefore I am. I don't like the students now.
We're now going to play in its entirety, 20 minutes, Michael Ratner's speech of January 20th, 2006 at Riverside Church that opened up the historic commission trying Bush for war crimes. Michael entitled his speech, "The Time to Act is Now, Tomorrow is Today."
When Clark called me yesterday and said, "I'll be sharing a platform with Harry Belafonte," I said, "Well, maybe you want to put me on for tomorrow." But here I am. And of course, I'm proud to be even in any kind of association with Harry Belafonte. And I'm sure you're all familiar with Harry Belafonte's comments that he made to President Chavez in Venezuela a few days ago. If you don't remember them, I'll repeat them. No matter what the greatest tyrant in the world, the greatest terrorist in the world, George W. Bush, says, "We're here to tell you, not hundreds, not thousands, but millions of the American people support your revolution." Now, what's remarkable about that, of course, Harry Belafonte was heavily attacked for that. But as he has never been willing to do, he did not retreat from the statement. And if you go on the net, you come to what he said. It's at the Children's Defense Fund a few days later. And what he says is, "So when I make my remarks, they may stir up controversy, but then it's time to talk about new definitions, new points of view." And that's what Harry Belafonte was doing, and that is what we are doing here today and over the next 2 days at these commissions. The other important point about being here at Riverside, of course, is that in April 1967, this is the place, this church, where Martin Luther King openly and notoriously, I should say, opposed the war in Vietnam. The speech was called "Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence." It's a historic place for that reason. And he began that speech with these words: "A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam." And then in that speech, he lays out a 5-point program, but the ultimate point of the program was remove all foreign troops from Vietnam. Incredibly, even though it was Martin Luther King saying that in 1967, it took 9 more years, millions of Vietnamese deaths, and thousands of American deaths to do so. We today model our conduct on that of Dr. Martin Luther King. As he said then, we say today, a time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relationship to the war in Iraq. It is time to bring the troops home now. A people's trial, a people's commission, is not without important precedents. Almost 40 years ago, in 1968, there was another people's trial. It was held in Sweden and Denmark. Originally, it was to be held in France, but the French wouldn't allow it. They prohibited it because it was about Vietnam, and of course, the French had been very deeply involved in the subjugation of Vietnam. The witnesses at that people's trial were well-known progressives, including Jean-Paul Sartre. They gathered in Stockholm and Copenhagen, and they were there to judge another human outrage in our history, the brutal and inhuman Vietnam War. Bertrand Russell, the famous English philosopher, was one of the key participants in that trial. In fact, it was called the Russell War Crimes Tribunal. Russell opened that trial, and here is what he said. "We meet at an alarming time. Overwhelming evidence besieges us daily of crimes without precedent. We investigate in order to expose. We document in order to indict. We arouse consciousness in order to create mass resistance." And so, as Russell said then, we say today, we are putting the Bush administration on trial. We investigate in order to expose. We document in order to indict. We arouse consciousness in order to create mass resistance. We want this trial to be a step in the building of mass resistance to war, to torture, to the destruction of our earth and its people. It's a serious moment. Our country and our world are at a tipping point, tipping toward permanent war, the end of human rights, and the impoverishment and death of millions. We still have a chance, an opportunity to stop this slide into chaos. But it is up to us. We must not sit with our arms folded. We must be as radical as the reality we are facing. The witnesses you will hear over the next few days are the truth tellers, the witnesses to the carnage this country and this administration has wrought. This truth challenges us all to act. We, particularly the American people, have not heard or seen the truth. And if some do, in their comfort and complacency, they often turn away. The truth is hidden. It is hidden through cover-up language, euphemisms, legalisms, obfuscations, false investigations, the blaming of low-level individuals, all meant to hide the reality of the criminal involvement of high officials of this administration, the criminal involvement in war, torture, global and human destruction. Let's take a look at a few of these examples, and there are many. The failure in this country, in the media, by pundits, everywhere we look, to look at the reality, a reality this commission will examine. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the first example, the war in Iraq. Supposedly, the war was to eliminate Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Now it is said that was a mistake. It was bad intelligence. The administration says it, and much of Congress says it. The press says it. Quote, "Had we only known, but we thought they had weapons of mass destruction. So we must in the future get better intelligence, as if that explains or excuses why we went to war. But of course, that explanation, the failure of intelligence, and still the current explanation of today by the elites, hides the real reasons for war. It blames some negligent officials, individuals at the CIA for leading us into war. All we need to do, according to them, is correct that, and we won't be in mistaken wars any longer. Mistaken wars will come to an end. If you believe that, you believe in the Tooth Fairy. We all know that is not the truth. In fact, in 1967, Martin Luther King predicted it. He said, "We will be marching and protesting wars for the rest of our lives as long as we are on the wrong side of history." And we are on the wrong side of history. Sometimes I ask myself, why did we progressives know the weapons of mass destruction story was a cover for war, but Congress and the media claimed they did not? Because they, all of them, Democrats, Republicans, the media, they were all reading from the same page. And that page is U.S. world exploitation and domination. And of course, what does the truth tell us about the war in Iraq? It tells us that it's an aggressive war, a crime against peace, and according to the judgment at Nuremberg, that kind of war is the most heinous of all war crimes. I can give you other examples. Clark had referred to one. For example, the fact that they say that we do not torture. All of a sudden, in this country, torture is not torture, or at worst, it is abuse. And even that abuse is no worse than a fraternity prank. Or if it was abuse, it was because abusive techniques were only for use in Guantanamo. Now, what sense does that make? They can be used in Guantanamo? And somehow they migrated to Iraq. But what does migrated to Iraq mean? Are they birds, like a bird migrates, without any human agent? Torture techniques move from one place to another. Or we are told that it was only a few bad apples, but no responsibilities for the higher up. And yet the media has gone along with this, with these lies and these cover-ups. Even worse, serious media discussion and respectability is given to the legal justifiers. For example, John Yoo, a lawyer for the administration, who wrote that you could torture in the name of national security, much like the Pinochet defense, torture in the name of national security. I was utterly shocked the other day when I pick up the New York Times, and there on the back page, they've asked a half a dozen people, what questions would you ask the potential new Supreme Court Justice Alito? And there they ask John Yoo what questions you would ask him. He was asked to submit his questions. What can you say except they are giving credibility to a man who shouldn't be on the back page of the New York Times, but it should be in the dock, but who should be in the dock facing justice. Let there be no doubt, this administration is engaged in massive violations of the law. Torture is an international crime. It's a grave breach of the Geneva Convention, and almost no one is telling you that. And in this country, it is anathema to do so. A third and last example I want to give you of the hiding of reality, of the blaming of individuals instead of the nature of this country and its leaders, is the example of what happened in New Orleans and Katrina. It's the preparation for and the aftermath of Katrina. What do we hear and read? It was an unpredictable act of God. It was a failure of FEMA. FEMA had a bad manager, all sorts of excuses, similar to what we heard about the so-called intelligence failures in the Iraq War. But the blame FEMA, the blame the individuals, obscures what we know occurred in New Orleans. What we saw in New Orleans and the Superdome was something very different. It was the legacy of slavery, the legacy of Jim Crow, the legacy of separate but equal. And it was the legacy and the current practice and policy of our country today, that human beings are seen as disposable, particularly if they are poor and black. That is the reality of New Orleans, and that is the reality faced every day in this country. And again, that is the reality this commission will bring you. The war, torture, and the effects of Katrina are not looked at as failures or the products of the system. The truth is hidden, and by hiding it, we are disempowered. So we are here this weekend to hear truth tellers, to empower people. It is not just a few bad apples. It is not just mistakes or bad choices. It is not just bad managers and getting better ones, but something much more fundamental. It's that awful alchemy, as Martin Luther King described it, in this very church, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism. I want to say a few words about one aspect of the current period that is extremely frightening, probably the most frightening, although it does have roots in prior administrations. The shorthand for the expression of this period and the scare and the fear that I feel is the king can do no wrong. Or the word might be tyranny, police state, or dictatorship. I recall that after 9/11, in fact, within a few months afterwards, I wrote an article. It was entitled, "Moving Toward a Police State or Have We Arrived?" And I remember being nervous about it because this was pretty aggressive to be saying a few months after 9/11. Was I going to get trashed for it? Did it really reflect reality? I wasn't sure. I had some evidence in front of me. I had the Patriot Act. I had internal detentions. I had the president's military order that allows him to pick up people anywhere in the world and detain them in Guantanamo or elsewhere. But I still was willing to say, moving toward a police state, not have we arrived. And a police state to me is one where authority is not under law, where the legislature is overridden, and where our courts are ignored, where one can be jailed without a court proceeding or trial, and where the president, king, or what have you, can do as he pleases, wiretap, torture, and disappear people. Unfortunately, and dangerously, that is the situation we are in today. You are familiar with much of the evidence, some of which I have laid out, and some of which the next 2 days will address. There is, however, one piece of important evidence I want to bring to your attention, in which the president, their president, not our president, is open and notorious about his aims, public, if you will. And if you miss it, you have to be an ostrich with your head in the ground. What he has done is basically lay the plan for what has to be called a coup d'etat in America. And it's a small paragraph, and it's contained in what we call a signing statement. It was signed on December 30th, and it's the signing statement to what we call the McCain Amendment. You probably all remember the McCain Amendment. That's the amendment that prohibits cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, or supposedly prohibits it. The president, as you recall, resisted the McCain Amendment, but in the end, he had to sign it because it was part of a broader military authorization to pay for what we're doing in Iraq. And when the president signs legislation, he sometimes, and more recently with President Bush, issues a signing statement as to what his understanding of the law is. The president's statement on McCain is only one short paragraph, but it's historic, it's unprecedented, and if you're looking for the grab for power that allows you, permits you, compels you to call this a tyranny, it is that paragraph. It makes 3 points, and I'll paraphrase them. First, speaking as the president, my authority as commander-in-chief allows me to do whatever I think is necessary in the war on terror, including use torture. Second, the commander-in-chief cannot be checked by Congress. Third, the commander-in-chief cannot be checked by the courts. There it is. There you have it. That boring stuff I learned as a junior high school student about checks and balances, or about limited law, or about authority under law, out the window, gone. In other words, the republic and the democracy is over. In Germany, what did they call that? They called that the Führer's law. Why? Because the Führer was the law. That's what George Bush is saying here. George Bush is the law. This assertion of power is so blatant, so open, and so notorious that it finally is shocking some people, such as former Vice President Gore, to speak up. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with what he said in his recent speech on Martin Luther King's birthday. Quote, "The President of the United States has been breaking the law repeatedly and persistently." He was referring to the NSA spying scandal. And then he went on to say, "A president who breaks the law is a threat to the very structure of our government." And then he said, "An executive who acts free from the will of Congress, as this president says he can, or the check of the judiciary, as this president says he can, becomes the central threat that the founders sought to nullify in the Constitution." And then he quotes James Madison to the effect that what President Bush has done is the very definition of tyranny. So there you have it. It's not just us, it's not just progressives, but even someone like former Vice President Gore is saying it, the very definition of tyranny. I believe that the president and this grab for power will be repudiated, but it will not just happen. The pendulum does not swing back automatically. It will take an aroused public and an aroused people. And so the question is really, where do we go from here? One place I can tell you not to go is don't go to the Democrats in Washington. I have to tell you, I have never in my life been kicked in the teeth so badly as I was on the Guantanamo cases when we took that to the Democrats in Washington. And I'm just going to say it here. There's a million reasons I can tell you you don't go there, but this one is called the Graham-Levin bill. And after we win the right to go to court for the detainees at Guantanamo, and we win that in the Supreme Court, Republican Senator Graham and Democrat Senator Levin get together, and what do they decide to do a few weeks ago but strip the courts of any jurisdiction to hear the Guantanamo cases? That's what they do, Democrats and Republicans together, and then they say you can use evidence from torture to keep those people in jail, kicking us right in the teeth, kicking the courts in the teeth. And so if you think that we are going to get far by going there, you've got it wrong. Lessons of history teach us that we don't move our leaders, without the passion and the protest of the people. I want to close with a sense of hope. It's been a rough 4 years. It's been a rough 20 years. It's been a rough 40 years since Dr. King spoke. But I want to close with a sense of hope. This administration is unraveling. There's a split in the elites. Gore is one of the best examples. Everywhere we see former administration officials speaking out. They realize the administration has gone too far. They want to save some remnant of democracy. We see indictments from Scooter Libby to DeLay coming fast and furious. We see General Miller, responsible for torture in Guantanamo and Iraq, taking the Fifth Amendment, essentially, so he won't have to testify. We see General Sanchez, who is head of troops in Iraq, retiring without that fourth star. It's a real opening for us, but it's not simply to go back to the normal. It's not simply to save a remnant of democracy. The malady is much deeper than that. We need a radical transformation of our society. My hopes for today and for the future is that the truth will arouse resistance, and with resistance, there will be some change. I mean resistance of every sort. Mobilizing, protesting, disobeying, and disobedience. And then again, when I was reading Dr. King's speech, the thought that he closed with and that I want to close with is that sometimes we can wait too long to take action. Or as Dr. King said, you can be too late. And we, unless we act, may be too late. So let me end with Dr. King's directive to us all. We are now faced with the fact, my friends, that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. There is such a thing as being too late. We still have a choice today. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. Thank you. We'll do this together.
We've just heard Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, give the introductory speech to the Bush War Crimes Tribunal last January 20th, 2006 at Riverside Church.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law & Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law & Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Everything is all right. Everything is all wrong. Everything is all right. Everything is all wrong. Nobody likes make things go wrong. And not one thing they start, they show mistake. A mistake they start, they show mistake. Mistake they make two kinds. One kind they call them good mistake. The other kind they call them bad mistake. Good mistake you fit repair. Bad mistake they cause disgrace. Mistake you go make, people go laugh at you. Mistake you go make, you fit stand like man. Mistake you go make, people fit laugh at you. After they laugh at you, them go smile again. Mistake you go make, your mind go clear like rain. After all the mistake, you still stand like a man. That means say everything is alright. That means say
everything's alright.
You are right, everything is alright. That means say
everything's alright.
You are right,
everything's alright.
That means say
everything's alright.
You are right,
everything's alright.
La 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 la. But mistake you go make, people go laugh at you. Mistake you go make, people go laugh at you. After they laugh at you, them keeps laughing at you. Mistake you go make, you go beg some man. You dey beg the man because you fear the man. Mistake you go make, you go shame to walk for road. Mistake you go make, you no go fit stand like man. Last day you are black, you know they think like black. That means say everything is all wrong. That means say
you
are wrong. That means say
you
are wrong. Now bad mistake. Colonial thinking, slavery thinking. I mean killing students, soldiers they for school. Bad mistake, now bad mistake, now bad mistake, now bad mistake. Colonial thinking, slavery thinking. I'm in killing students, soldiers for school. I'm in burning houses, now bad mistake.